Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Rabbi Mark Wilds, millennial advisor, founder of the Manhattan Jewish Experience, and author of the new book, Beyond the Instant. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Two Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden. And we welcome two new young representatives of Israel, our Shinshinyot, Ron Benekot and Rotem Rappaport. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom and Lashana Tova. It's a new Jewish year, just 7 days old, which means we're still in the midst of the Aseret Yemei Tshuva, the 10 days of repentance that run from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, from the Day of Judgment, the Day of the New Year, to the conclusion of the appeal process before God that completes itself on the Day of Atonement. This Jewish season is always a time of exaltation. That's why they call these the High Holy Days in our tradition. But there's also a certain sense of pressure. In the midst of these 10 days, we try to right the wrongs we've done in the past year, to reconcile with anybody we've injured or offended. It's a challenge to heal our actions over the past 12 months. It's perhaps a greater challenge to try to change the habits we fall into that lead us to do things that we aren't proud of. Our goal during these days of awe is to look honestly at ourselves and to ask God to forgive us those failings we've committed in the past year, and so to again become whole. But as the Talmud tells us, for sins against God, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, atones, but for sins against other human beings, the Day of Atonement does not atone until we have made atonement to them personally. God cannot heal the breaches in our relationships. Only we can do that by going to the people we've wronged and asking them to forgive us. So this is the most important time of year for us morally, a crucial period of reflection, self-examination, and what Israelis call cheshbon ha-nefesh, taking an accounting of our souls. On Yom Kippur, the fast day of atonement, holiest day of the whole Jewish year, which begins at sundown this Tuesday, we commit ourselves to try to repair our own world through repentance, prayer, and charity, teshuvah, tefillah, utzedakah. The melody that captures the essence of Yom Kippur best is also the only melody people come to temple just to hear, the Kol Nidre, the renunciation of failed vows that begins the evening of Yom Kippur. It's the melody that, for many people, is at the heart of the Jewish experience. It captures it with just a few moments of music. Here's the great cantor Moshe Oysher's rendition of the first sections of the Kol Nidre. That was the remarkable Moshe Osher's Kol Nidre for Yom Kippur, which is coming up this Tuesday night. Kol Nidre is designed to bring us close to what is holiest within us. At this time of atonement and return, we do well to remember as well that holiness begins for Jews with personal actions, mitzvot, not simply words or professions of faith. The way to improve the world is by doing acts of goodness, blessing, and courage, not talking about them, even with God. That's what we dedicate ourselves to this week, actions that matter and improve the world. Nevertheless, we do need to ask God for help. And that's never more clear than in the Kol Nidre's soaring conclusion. Here's cantor and opera star Jan Pierce singing the end of the Kol Nidre. We could do an entire show on the melody of Kol Nidre, its many interpretations. We could tell famous stories about Kol Nidre Eve, jokes about Kol Nidre, and so on. But the truth is, the only way to truly appreciate Kol Nidre is to hear it live, in a synagogue, this Tuesday night, the eve of Yom Kippur, in a room filled with fervent prayer, soaring music, white clothing and prayer shawls, and the power of the great Day of Atonement. It's a truly amazing experience. And it takes place just one night a year, this coming Tuesday, at a synagogue near you. And all of it is there to bring us tshuva, repentance, to help us learn how to work to heal injustice and brokenness in our lives and in our world. Our guest this morning, Rabbi Mark Wilds, does some of that all by himself. He is a millennial advisor, the founder of the Manhattan Jewish Experience, author of the new book, Beyond the Instant, about romantic relationships in this challenging era. Meet Mark Wilds, and we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. He is the very innovative Rabbi Mark Wilds, the founder and director of the Manhattan Jewish Experience. I don't know how this may be the wrong way to put it, but some people see him as the millennial Jewish whisperer. He has a new book out, Beyond the Instant. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning and thank you for having me. It's an honor.
It's a pleasure. Tell us a little bit I guess, about how your work with millennials has evolved, and a little bit about kind of the whole orientation of your rabbinate.
So, again, thanks for having me. It's really a pleasure and honor. You know, I started out as a rabbi as a millennial. I was basically the same age as the people I was engaging. I was in my early to mid-20s when I started reaching out and trying to engage less affiliated Jewish men and women. I was never so inspired or excited to sort of preach to the choir. I always loved the challenge of engaging and learning with and teaching individuals that were not really in the fold, that were not really in the community. Much of American Jewry is just not terribly committed or engaged Jewishly, and I happen to love that population. And the ideas that I began to share, the organization that I created back in August of 98, just seemed to work, and it still, thank God, seems to resonate with people in their 20s and 30s. But I think that the message of classical Judaism has a lot to say to young people, and it's been lost on a whole generation, and not just Jews. I think the message of classical monotheism and its value system could be incredibly helpful in confronting some of the happiness and relationship issues that millennials and young people are confronting today. And I love, you know, sharing those ideas and helping people find greater happiness and joy in life through the Torah. So that's sort of how it developed, just, I guess, ideologically. I'm a lawyer by training. I went to...
You went to Cardozo, didn't you?
I went to Cardozo, and I combined it with a degree in international affairs from Columbia, and I had this whole plan. I was going to save Soviet Jewry. I was incredibly involved with refuseniks and Soviet Jews and dissidents and human rights and international law. It was my whole life. I worked for my congressman and my senator growing up, and I worked for the Coalition of Free Soviet Jews, and then they got out.
They got out, yeah. Ruined your whole life plan, Mark.
I mean, you're making a joke, but I literally created... I went to Columbia to study in the Harriman Institute for Soviet Studies. Wow. Because I wanted to become a Sovietologist, not because I cared about Russia, but because I cared about Russian Jews.
Yeah.
And then they get out. And I was like, okay, now what?
Yeah, what do you do when you get what you hope for before you even got a chance to really work on it?
That's a great story.
Oh my God, it's so true. By the way, I'll tell you, there's a moment I will never forget. My dad is an immigration lawyer his whole life. He represented John Lennon. He had a lot of very famous clients. My brother took over. I was being groomed for that. I worked for him for a little. And my dad got a six-month visitor visa for a woman by the name of Carmela Raiz. Unbelievable woman. This lady took on the gulag and the Soviets, and she lobbied Congress to get her husband, who was denied immigration rights for 25 years. I was standing in my dad's kitchen when she got out with a very dear friend, Bernie Kaplan of blessed memory, who got me into Soviet Jewry, into the whole issue. And I looked at him, and I was like, okay, she's out. Now what?
Right.
Oh, there are plenty more refuseniks to come. So that was great. But then when Perestroika and Glasnost and
the wall came down.
Like, I needed a new cause. And my cause has been, for the last 20 years, it's been outreach to the less affiliated, because I feel, besides ideologically, you know, finding things in Judaism that speak to that population, which I love to do, I just feel like we're killing ourselves here. You know, we're just losing so many of our brothers and sisters, and we're losing them to ignorance. We're not losing them because Judaism can't make a compelling case. No one's really making the case that a life of Torah can really be not only inspiring but compelling intellectually, and that's what I love to do.
We will talk much more with Rabbi Mark Wilds and hear about his new book, Beyond the Instant, and keep addressing this question. We come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O JewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or stream us from there or download us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular podcasts, Top 10 Jewish Podcasts in America, according to Moment Magazine. You know, we played a couple of outstanding renditions of Kol Nidre at the beginning of this show, but I would be remiss if I omitted my least favorite Kol Nidre of all time. In the mid-20th century, Jews had a strong connection to their heritage, but they represented a disproportionate percentage of the record-buying public. Producing a record that these Jews would be interested in was fairly important commercially. And that's probably why Johnny Mathis, of all people, recorded the single worst Kol Nidre ever sung. Here it is.
Kol Nidre.
Nothing like Johnny Mathis warbling Kol Nidre with vague versions of the actual Aramaic words to make you feel introspective, or perhaps more accurately, slightly sick. Kind of how you feel after fasting for a lot of hours, a little sick to your stomach. Well, if in spite of my less than stellar recommendation you like that, you should definitely look up Johnny Mathis' version of Ailey Ailey on YouTube. Not for the faint of heart or stomach.
We welcome our maven on Israel, Amir Eden, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Amir.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So, Gmar Chatima Tova.
Gmar Chatima Tova. Tov.
We're getting close for now in the Aseret Yemei Tshuva, the 10 days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur in America, holiest day of the year, but we still have to have long conversations with parents about not putting their kids in school or people not going to work. Yeah. It is not like that in Israel.
No, it's not. So as a Jewish state, everything is just closed. You know, all schools, all restaurants, all stores. As a matter of fact, no one drives in the entire country. Can't drive if you want to. No one drives. We all respect Yom Kippur. So just imagine, you know, it's like probably for Americans who've never been in Israel, kind of like a science fiction movie, coming out from your house, going to the main roads, not even one car, right?
Yeah.
So really, and for little children, you know, young children, it's on one hand, fasting. I can tell you the majority of my friends growing up fasted. And so it's going outside as a middle school kid or even younger and showing your tongue, proving that you fasted and just having this quiet around.
So the concept in Israel, very common, and it's true all over Judaism, but particularly in Israel, they talk about a cheshbon ha-nefesh.
Yes.
It's a time when we take literally an accounting of our souls.
Right.
And even for the people that don't go to Beit Knesset, that don't go to the synagogue, the total chilonim that wouldn't come into a synagogue, they will take the day to
Absolutely.
Do a self-evaluation.
I'll add to it, there's no television, no radio stations.
Right.
Nothing, just quiet. So you got time. You got time to think. You know, think about the past year. Think about how you treated your friends and other people, and really take your time and try your best to do better. You know, the next year.
It's a great message. You know, this is not just in Jerusalem. You know, in Jerusalem, Shabbat is very quiet.
No, the entire country.
But really, even in the most vital secular
just
parts
everywhere.
Of the country,
yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. When does everybody go to a break fast at the end of Yom Kippur?
They do. They do. You know, it depends on the family tradition. Many of them just will do it at home and invite friends. There are those who will go to a restaurant. You know, all depends.
Sure.
Yeah.
So Be'er Sheva, could be a little warm around Yom Kippur, no?
Yes.
Kind of like Tucson, Arizona.
Correct. But evening time is nice. Nice weather. I can tell you that there's a tradition in Yom Kippur growing up that kids and teens will meet at the different intersections. You know, that's growing up. I remember, you know, in Be'er Sheva, we had two places you can go and meet your friends and just share how Yom Kippur was for you.
And this is at the end of Yom Kippur, after Ne'ilah or the conclusion.
Correct.
It's kind of a beautiful thing. I will say that's a very ancient tradition, because in the days of the Temple in Jerusalem, after the Kohen Gadol went into the Holy of Holies, Kodesh Kodeshim, on Yom Kippur, he came out and he was alive. People thought, okay, it might be a good year. In the afternoon, after that, on Yom Kippur, but people were still fasting, but they say young people, men and women, would meet, and they would, like, that's where a lot of the shidduchin took place. Like, it was a matchmaking.
Nice.
So for teens to meet after Yom Kippur,
absolutely,
it's following a great tradition.
It is. Very special.
Atzom Kal, an easy fast.
Thank you.
We'll talk next week.
Absolutely.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And L'shana Tova, Tikatevu V'techa, Temu Gmar Chatima Tova.
And to you, thank you.
We've been talking about the term you maybe invented, the self-ghettoization of the Jews. Began in Europe and North Africa and kind of the rest of the world, and have worked our way back through the development of American kind of consciousness of how we interact in a highly non-Jewish environment. The effect, I think, has been a little different here in terms of there was a time in the post-war period when Jews, even though they clearly had a sense of if they were Reform, Conservative, or Orthodox, but they interacted across the Jewish world pretty freely and pretty comfortably.
Yeah, there was a time when pretty much all American Jews were at least familiar firsthand through a grandparent or an aunt or an uncle with
the
practices of Orthodox Jewry.
Right.
And they didn't view Orthodox people as extraterrestrials, incomprehensible, whatever. And vice versa. Orthodox people all had relatives who went in other directions, and they were still part of the mishpacha and part of the community. So, although American Jews have never been subject to, and I should keep correcting myself and say North American Jews, we've never been subjected to legal ghettoization, and we haven't engaged in a tremendous amount of self-ghettoization, what I see happening in the last 50 years is increasing distance between and among various elements of the Jewish community. And let me explain what I mean by that. When I was a kid, which was, you know, less than 50 years ago, there was a lot of ecumenical activity within the Jewish community, broad spectrum from almost the most extreme ultra-Orthodox to almost the most extreme secular Jews. And it manifested itself in responses to the civil rights movement, in sort of community observances of days like Thanksgiving. I mean, I can remember going to a community-wide service on Thanksgiving Day in an Orthodox shul when I was a boy in St. Louis, where, because it was not a religious service and it wasn't a Jewish holiday, the Orthodox synagogue dropped its normal tradition of separate seating for men and women, and everybody sat together, and we sang My Country, Tis of Thee, and read historic readings, and, you know, we might have concluded with Adon Olam or something, but it was largely a community-wide observance of an American holiday within the Jewish community. And I think you mentioned off-air that you remember other things
Right. I mean, I remember even in as late as the 1970s, almost to the 80s, there were areas that had a communal Beit Din for conversions. That meant that when you need a court of three rabbis to convert someone to Judaism and for some other purposes, divorce and so on, And for that, there were some that had Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform rabbis sitting on the same Beit Din as late as the 1970s and early 80s.
Was this only in L.A.?
No, no. It was in Denver. It was in a few other places around the country. It wasn't universal, and it was done kind of a little bit sub rosa, like nobody put a big sign up about it, but you knew it existed. Nobody thought it was a terrible thing. No rabbinical organization was going to throw out the rabbi because he was sitting with these awful, you know, other denominational rabbis.
So this is a reflection of what I was talking about, sort of ecumenical spirit within the Jewish community.
Yeah, you're calling us, we're all part of the
that has people. Largely vanished. And maybe it's worth taking a look next time
absolutely.
At why it's vanished and why we're so different now.
And what the implications are for that. Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week. An easy fest.
And to you.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your bubby, it's Zany New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. The rabbi is opening his mail one morning. Taking a single sheet of paper from a blank envelope, he finds written on it only one word, schmuck. At the next Friday night Shabbat service, the rabbi announces, I have known many people who have written letters and forgotten to sign their names, but this week I received a letter from someone who signed his name, but forgot to write a letter. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shiniot, our representatives of Israel from the Weintraub Israel Center and from Israel, Rotem Rappaport and Ron Benekot, who are here and explaining about Israel. Listen, Gemar Chatima Tova, I hope you had a good Rosh Hashanah. Now we're coming into Yom Kippur. Most important day of the year religiously. Tell us about your experience of Yom Kippur in Israel.
Actually, in Israel, I wasn't very close to all the religious part, but Yom Kippur was very important to me to do and to experience because it's a day to really connect with yourself and be with your friends and family without anything that's interrupting and really think about your year and what you've done. And it's really important for me to do every year, even though I'm not that religious.
Right. It's called a cheshbon ha-nefesh, right? An accounting of the soul. And it seems to me that, I mean, you have to be not just a secular Israeli, you almost have to be not Jewish not to do Yom Kippur if you're in Israel. That's not so true in America. Not everybody does the same thing. Do you know people, well, tell us a little bit about your experience and if it's similar or how it varies.
So my family is not religious and they don't keep Yom Kippur. But because it's so important to me, like Otam said, to connect with yourself and just to start the new year with a clear mind about everything, I go to a friend's house every Yom Kippur and we somewhat together. I don't know how to say it in English.
You fast, right?
Fast.
Tom, fast day, right? You got to get together not to eat.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's something about fasting that changes us a little bit. I mean, how often do you guys fast, right? Never, I hope.
Only in Yom Kippur.
Only in Yom Kippur, right?
Yes.
So that experience itself becomes kind of a physical exploration of, you know, change.
I think it's not only mental, that feeling that you're all clean, but like physically, you feel clean, you feel like pure and
like you've emptied yourself.
Ready, yeah, you're ready for to start the new year.
Yeah,
it's like a whole new person.
It's beautiful. At the end of Yom Kippur, it's customary here to have a break fast. I assume it's similar, but tell me a little bit, even in religious and non-religious settings, both, you know, Chiloni and Dati, there's still something at the end of Yom Kippur, right?
Yeah, we have a big dinner at the beginning and the end of Yom Kippur. In my moshav...
My favorite parts of Yom Kippur,
yeah.
I have to say.
In my moshav, we go to the Bet Knesset just to hear the shofar.
The shofar at the end, like at the end of Ne'ilah, right?
And see the stars, and then everyone goes to their home to eat the big dinner.
So, and for you, Ron?
I also go to the Bet Knesset, of course.
To the synagogue?
Yeah, to the synagogue.
And even if you never go to the synagogue, the whole rest of the year, Yom Kippur.
Yeah, it's right. really, yeah. it feels like, not like it's mandatory, but you want to do it. And it's different than all the other days. I can't explain why. It's just like something inside of you. You just feel it.
Well, I hope that it's a tzomkal, an easy fast for both of you,
Thank you.
A beautiful
Thank
Yom
you.
Kippur.
Thank you.
Gemara Tov.
Ma'a Tova.
And now a word of Torah. This week, we read the great Torah portions of Yom Kippur, which falls Tuesday night and Wednesday. They explore holiness and commitment to God. In the Reformed tradition, in the morning of Yom Kippur, we'll read the portion from Nitzavim in Deuteronomy that affirms that we have the responsibility in this great season to choose life and choose God. In the afternoon of Yom Kippur, we will chant from Kiddushim, the holiness code, that teaches us how to be holy through sacred and ethical lives. And next Shabbat, we'll chant one of the final portions of the entire Torah reading cycle, Ha'azinu, the penultimate section of the final book of the Torah, Devarim. Ha'azinu is made up of Moses' last poetic words to the people of Israel before his death. It's an elaborate instruction, a charge, and a prediction of the future for the Israelites. Ha'azinu is both a final look inside the thoughts of the greatest leader our people has ever had, and a fascinating snapshot of what was predicted for the future of the 12 tribes once they arrived in the land of Israel. Ha'azinu is a longish poem, and the powerful poetry includes a description of God's word dropping like gentle rain on tender grass, and a vision of the Lord's justice and faith flowing complete and flawless. Ha'azinu describes God's love for Israel, bringing forth honey from the rock to nourish and favor our people, a kind of prediction of the way that Israel has made the desert bloom today, if you like. In language rich and complex, but also challenging, Moses promises God will reward those who preserve justice, but punish those who fail to keep faith with God. And in one memorable phrase that has made its way into our prayer book, Moses says, Ki shem Adonai ekra havu godel Eloheinu, I will proclaim the name of the Lord and ascribe greatness to our God. Accordingly, our role as Jews is both to praise God and to create justice. Both are important and both support each other in our world. We praise God and acknowledge that justice comes from the one source of morality. And then we work to assure that justice for all is central to our moral life. We must strive not only to be good, but also to assure goodness exists in our world. May you be sealed in the book of life for a good year, a Gemar Chatima Tova, and have an easy fast on Yom Kippur. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Mark Wilds, an expert on Jewish millennials, the creator of the Manhattan Jewish Experience and author of a new book on relationships, Beyond the Instant, will explain just how he helps young people use Jewish ideas and wisdom to live well in our society today. Find out when we return in, well, an instant. Here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Tel Aviv will host the 2019 Eurovision Song Contest. The event will be held at the Expo Tel Aviv International Convention Center. The Tel Aviv-Yafo Municipality and Eurovision announced last week. The dates of the event also were announced. The semifinals will be on May 14th and 16th, and the grand final will take place May 18th, 2019. Both Jerusalem and Eilat also vied to host the live contest. Last year, it attracted 186 million television viewers. 20,000 tourists are expected to arrive in Tel Aviv to participate in Eurovision events. Israel won the right to host the 2019 Eurovision after singer Netta Barzilai won the competition in May with her song Toy. Israel, which has won the contest four times, will host it for the third time, having previously staged Eurovision in Jerusalem in 79 and 99. Israel has participated in the contest 42 times since its first appearance in 1973. German Jewish groups are angry that an attack on a kosher restaurant and its owner in Chemnitz during last month's riots in that former East German city were publicly ignored by authorities for more than a week. During anti-migrant demonstrations that turned violent back on August 27th, 12 masked neo-Nazis injured Uwe Giobala and vandalized his Shalom restaurant. The attackers threw stones, bottles, and a sawed-off steel pipe at Giobala and shouted, "Get out of Germany, you Jewish pig!" A window in the restaurant was broken, and Giobala was injured when a stone hit him. Giobala has filed charges, according to the State Criminal Investigation Office in Saxony. Giobala reported that the police arrived quickly on the scene after he called, but it took a few days to secure evidence and record damage. The incident was finally confirmed by police only on September 6th. Local news media had reported the incident already. The Berlin-based Jewish Forum for Democracy and Against Anti-Semitism learned of the attack on September 5th through the media and obtained photographs of attackers dressed in black in front of the restaurant. Germany's new commissioner against anti-Semitism, Felix Klein, said that the incident appeared to represent a turn for the worse in anti-Semitic crimes. "It's reminiscent of our worst recollections of the 1930s," he said. Charlotte Knobloch, head of the Jewish community of Munich and Bavaria, said on the eve of Rosh Hashanah that the violent anti-migrant demonstrations in Chemnitz, maybe it's Chemnitz, were a wake-up call for the government and society. "The fact that there was a violent attack on the restaurant Shalom and its owner is shocking and underscores the urgency of resolute action against anti-democratic forces," added Knobloch, who survived the Holocaust hiding with a Christian family in Germany. Giobala told the German Daily Die Welt he has often been subjected to anti-Semitic incidents, including having swastikas painted on his storefront and pig heads left the door. Nevertheless, he will keep the restaurant open. An Israeli teen visiting Yosemite National Park fell to his death trying to take a selfie. Tomer Frankfurter, 18 years old, a resident of Jerusalem, was on a two-month trip to the U.S. when he died. He plunged more than 800 feet after he slipped off a cliff at Yosemite. Frankfurter's mother confirmed her son's death with Israel's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. The ministry said the teen's body was brought back to Israel for burial. Yosemite National Park is no stranger to rock climbing-related deaths. In June, two climbers died scaling Yosemite's iconic El Capitan rock formation. Another hiker died in May climbing the picturesque Half Dome peak above Yosemite Valley. "It's always a terrible tragedy when someone dies in an accident in Yosemite. That an Israeli teen died a senseless death while taking a selfie just underscores the need for young people to take great care in such circumstances." And last week, Sweden announced plans to launch a Holocaust museum with a focus on survivors from the Scandinavian country, and a center devoted to the diplomat Raoul Wallenberg. Swedish Minister of Social Affairs and Sports Minister Annika Strandahl said the museum feels more important than ever. It's tentatively slated to be ready to open in 2020. A center on Wallenberg, the Swede who saved tens of thousands of Hungarian Jews from the Nazis during the Holocaust, is expected to attract international visitors. Raoul Wallenberg is perhaps the greatest of the many righteous Gentiles who sacrificed to save Jews during the Shoah. Wallenberg disappeared into a Soviet prison after World War II, later died there. The museum will focus on Swedes who survived the Holocaust and collect items, interviews, and documents about their experiences. Many of these are currently scattered in museums, archives, and private homes. Most importantly, the Swedish Holocaust Museum will be built in Malmö, a city of about 350,000 where dozens of anti-Semitic incidents are recorded annually. In Malmö, first and second generation immigrants from the Middle East make up a third of the population, and anti-Semitic activities have been endemic. Several hundred Jews live in this southern Swedish industrial city, just across the bridge from Copenhagen, Denmark, and Sweden's choice to build its Holocaust Museum there is a sign the government is making a serious effort to address the problem of anti-Semitism in Malmö. And that's the news of Jews around the world.
We welcome back to Two Jewish, our dynamic guest this morning, Rabbi Mark Wilds. He's the founder director of the Manhattan Jewish Experience, pioneering outreach to millennial Jews in a very effective and fascinating way. He has a new book out called Beyond the Instant. When we spoke earlier in the show, you were talking about how much you love this work with millennials and how many we're losing. The statistics are intimidating. They show that your generation, millennials, don't join organizations in the way that all previous generations of Jews have, that they don't commit to synagogues, that mostly they don't commit. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes and no. You know, I guess I can't argue with the numbers, you know, when they do these studies and, you know, but I get a little annoyed sometimes when I hear that, because not only because I have so many close friends and I feel like they're being a little, I don't want to say bad mouth, but, you know, they just haven't been approached in the right way, in my opinion. They're a different population. They need to be engaged in a certain kind of way. And I think they've just been turned off to Judaism from a very, very young age. Judaism, unfortunately, in America is not presented in a terribly exciting or compelling manner. I just came back from a trip to Israel. We brought 47 people to Israel, and I can't even tell you how many of these people, all in their 20s and 30s. And some of them have been to Israel before, a lot of them were not. But they just saw a whole side of Judaism that they didn't even know existed. And, you know, and it's not really their fault. Basically graduated from Judaism at the age of 12 or 13, bar bat mitzvah. And, you know, let's face it, at that age, how exciting, you know, or interesting is Judaism going to be? And then they go to college and get advanced degrees. And their whole understanding of Judaism is on a third grade level. And it paled in comparison to whatever...
No, that's not fair. It's at the seventh grade level, let's be honest. They're 13.
Yeah, again, I mean, I'm just reinforcing your point. I'm sorry.
Yeah, 100%. It probably is at the seventh grade level. And it makes Judaism look infantile. It makes it look
right,
like it doesn't have anything sophisticated or real to say about life. For that, I'm going to go to my college professor. I'm going to go to my mentor in graduate school. And I'm not saying there isn't wisdom to be found there, but it's just a shame because I think there's a greater depth of wisdom from Judaism that is being lost on this generation. So, you know, your question is a good one. How do we engage them? I think they haven't been engaged, and we need to recognize that the experiences they've had growing up Jewishly have not been very inspiring or interesting, and therefore they're not so committed. They're not making commitments. Is it because they're in general not a commit? I don't think so. I think I've seen over the last 20 years, lots of young people make big commitments to their Judaism, but it's only after they've seen the relevance of Judaism in their lives. But I think once they see that relevance, they make commitments 100%.
Tell us how your work with relationships plays into this and how your book evolved, your new book.
So, you know, because we're reaching out to millennials, this is an interesting stage in people's life where people are dating. I wouldn't say simply recreationally. I think they're dating to actually meet someone. I'm not saying they necessarily want to get married tomorrow, but they're meeting, and MGE has been playing off of that. I'd love to believe everybody comes to MGE simply because they're interested in learning more about Judaism. I think some people come to MGE for that reason, but a lot of people come because they want to be part of a community. They want to meet other people. It could be their significant other, or it could just be more friends. New York can be a lonely place, so we're like a real meeting. We have three sites in the city, and people just come to mingle and to schmooze and to connect socially. And the friendships that have developed from the programs that people attend have just been unbelievable. I mean, I see this all the time. My students, I bump into them on the street. They're hanging out with each other. They met here. And because it's such a meeting place, we've been working off of that, not just to attract students, but it also helps to grow community. And it also gives a certain fellowship with each other, a certain camaraderie. I'm learning more about my Judaism. I'm 25 years old. I'm an attorney. I'm a doctor. I'm a therapist. I'm a teacher in the public school system. But I don't really know much about my Judaism. I'm going to learn more about it, but I'm doing it together with friends. And I may even meet my significant other. We have 319 couples that have met and married through MGE since our founding 20 years ago. So I'm very proud of that number. And I'm hoping more people will meet and get married and find, you know, joy in a life that's got Judaism at its center. When I wrote the book, Beyond the Instant, and I see people struggling with relationships, and I see people struggling to find the right person, and not really knowing what the criteria, what should I be looking for in a potential spouse? And they have a lot of young couples already married who are struggling with, how do I keep this relationship going for the long run? How do I sustain? We are a generation where more than 50% of the people who come here are parents, are children from divorced families. So there's a lot of apprehension and hesitation when it comes to dating and committing, because they haven't seen always the greatest models of marriage in their own homes. So I wrote this book, and I devoted a couple of chapters, the first one to happiness in general, the next one to relationships and what we should be looking for in a potential spouse. And then I put a whole other chapter on sex, because I think the Torah perspective on sexuality is a very important one, often misunderstood. And I think people need a little direction, a little spiritual direction when it comes to that area of life. And the theme running throughout all the chapters is Beyond the Instant. The idea that so many young people are struggling with, to find something that's lasting and that's sustainable. And yeah, I can get a little high from this and a little high from that. It could be circumstances in my life. I got a promotion. I got the date. The girl will go out with me a second time. But what is going to give me sustainable, long-lasting happiness? What we like to call contentment. And that's really what I spent. I mean, every chapter relates to it in one way or another. And I just see that's what young people are struggling with.
Well, and you can sort of understand that in a culture in which everything needs to be conveyed immediately on social media, in which a lot of our social media is there and literally disappears unless somebody takes a screenshot of it. Everything really is sort of, and if there's anything faster than instant gratification, I don't know what it is, but isn't that kind of a continual message of our society now?
It is a continual message, and it's something that young people have to work against, because the real satisfaction, the real joys in life are things that take a long time to develop. Relationships, career, these things don't happen overnight, and you have to keep at it, and you can't give up so easily. And I think you're entirely correct. The whole instantaneous nature of our existence, where we get things so quickly, and if we don't get them quickly, we just move on to the next thing. We just swipe the other way. And that is, those subliminal messages, they play out in the most important parts of our lives, and it's really wreaking havoc with people. So the idea is to get people to slow down and to start focusing on certain important values in life, and not to give up too easily. One of the chapters I wrote about is, I called it Failing Forward, because failure is something young people are not doing well with. And when I say not doing well with, I don't mean that they're failing a lot. That's fine. Failure is how we learn and grow, as I say in the book. But the problem is young people are not staying the course long enough to push through the failure to achieve levels of success. People are moving around from job to job too quickly. They're moving from relationship to relationship, and they're not giving it the time. And the repeated attempts, one of my favorite lines in the failure chapters, I quote the famous Thomas Edison, who was once asked when he was inventing the light bulb, how it felt to fail so many times. He said something like 9,000 experiments he went through, and he says, I never failed once. It was just 9,000 attempts of trial and error to be able to account. He says, now I know the 9,000 things I shouldn't do, something like that. I'm not quoting it properly. But it's such an important line, because that's how we humans learn to grow. You ever see a kid, a little baby, learning to walk? When my kids were little, I never understood. They seemed so foolish. They kept falling on their little tushes. And then they would stand back up, and every time the baby fell, would just keep getting up. And that's something an adult can learn from a child, because somehow the child instinctively knows that in order to eventually learn how to walk, it has to just keep getting back up. You'd figure after a while the kid would learn to stay down.
Right.
But there was actually a study conducted by the Wall Street Journal. It was reported in the Wall Street Journal many years ago about entrepreneurs in the United States, that between the years like 2003, 2015, the entrepreneurship in terms of age went up. The population willing to take risks and start a new venture that might fail is beginning older and older and older. 50 and up right now is the highest population of entrepreneur, startups in the country. You always think startups are by young people. It's not true. Young people are more hesitant to fail. I think it has to do with, in the theory, I feel strongly about it. And I didn't put this in the book, but I'm just telling you, I think it has to do with the fact that, you know, parents, and I'm a parent, and I'm guilty of this like anyone else. You know, we want everybody to feel good all the time. We're a generation that struggles with self-esteem. So we want our kids to always feel good. We don't want them to feel like they failed.
Everybody so has to get a participation trophy, right?
Everybody gets a trophy. And you know what happens after you keep telling that to your child? They become too cautious, because all they want to do is succeed. They can't handle, they've never learned to experience the feeling of failure.
Yeah.
And talk to the most successful people in the world, whether it's in the world of science, technology, or finance, it's all about the failure.
And the by the way, the book is not a failure. Beyond the Instant, Jewish Wisdom for Lasting Happiness in a Fast-Paced Social Media World. Where can people go to find out more about you and your work, Mark? I feel like we could go on for a long time, but we are out of time. What's the best place to find out more about you and about the book?
You can go to markwildes.com.
And I should say W-I-L-D-E-S.
Markwildes. .com. That's my website. Or you can go to MJE, Manhattan Jewish Experiences Facebook page or website, which is jewishexperience.org. So either my website, markwildes.com, or jewishexperience.org for more information. Or you can go to my Facebook page as well, Rabbi Mark Wildes.
Thank you so much, and a good and a healthy year.
Thank you so much. It was an honor and a pleasure, and I hope the book can help.
Absolutely. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Tom Siegel, author of the new novel, The Astronaut's Son. And, of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Top 10 Jewish podcasts in America. Our playout this morning comes from a hymn from the conclusion of Yom Kippur, Ne'ilah, El Nora Alilah, God Raised and Exalted. This is a spirited version of this lovely piyut. Yom Kippur is coming up Tuesday night and Wednesday, so my friends, may you have an easy fast, a tzom kal, and a gemar chatima tova. May you be sealed, and your family as well, in the book of life for a good year, and of course, a week and a year, we pray, of peace.
שם מחב פי שם וככה שם ואף ציה מחילה בשעת הנעילה אלה נורא עלילה אלה נורא עלילה.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.